This is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 1st, 2009, and this is show number 193. We've got a really big shoe today, so let's dig right in. Last week in Dumb Question Corner, I answered Michael's question, and I really enjoyed what he wrote back, so I'm going to read it to you. Here's what he said. Wow, I wasn't surprised that you responded so quickly, and to merit such a response on the podcast, that impressed me. I did sit in on Ustream for a few minutes and was surprised at how much effort it takes to create a show. But in the same way I don't want to see what is going on in the kitchen of a fancy restaurant that I eat at, I think I'd rather enjoy the finished product. Thanks again, and I will keep in touch. Regards, Michael. I'm so glad he wrote this. You know, a lot of people get a real kick out of the Ustream live show, 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sunday nights at ustream.tv/nosilicast. But I can see how watching the sausage get made might make take some of the fun out of it. I do appreciate that he sees how hard it is. I think it's a labor of love, but there is a lot of mechanics to the whole thing. Speaking of mechanics, this weekend I actually figured out how to do chit-chat across the pond live with both Bart's video and my video showing up on Ustream. We did it for a small, rather spontaneous audience who jumped over from Twitter to watch us. One person pointed out, though, that if you watch Chit Chat Across the Pond and then you go to the live show, there's pretty much nothing left at all on Monday morning. Well, the best part about podcasting is it's all about you. It's what you want, when you want, and how you want it. By the way, I'll be doing a tutorial on how I cracked the code of sending both videos to Ustream. Here's a hint. All I needed was three cameras, Audio Hijack Pro, Sound Source, CamTwist, Skype, and Ustream to make it happen. Easy peasy. I'm a big fan of mashups, where, you know, where clever developers figure out how to aggregate a bunch of stuff together to give us new information. My favorite this week is a website called Addictomatic.com. The idea is to enter some words, and Addictomatic will give you the recent mentions of those terms from Twitter, Live.com News, YouTube, Blog Lines, Google Blog Search, Dig, Flickr, Truvio Video Search, Ask.com News, Blix Mainstream, Wikio, Technorati, WordPress.com, and Yahoo Web Search. Whew, I hadn't even heard of some of those. Now, it sounds like this would be a big mess, but the site has a calm, dark background, kind of a dark gray background, and each service is in a calm, white, and beige rounded blocks. It's not messy at all. It's really quite pleasing. If you like some of these services better than others, all you have to do is drag their boxes around to put your favorites at the top, and you can even click the X in the corner of a box to banish it from your view. This kind of mix-and-match, dragging interface, it just makes me so happy. I love just moving the boxes around. You can also click on available sources in the menu bar and see even more sources than I already listed. You can turn off sources from this view, too, which might be a little easier if you want to just narrow it down to a couple. I guess I should give an example here so you can get a better idea of what you would do with this. I typed in Macintosh Windows, and from many of these services, I found cool tools and toys that worked on both the Mac and Windows. Since this is all freeform, you can look up anything you want. Midwest tornadoes, golf clubs, baby chickens, whatever interests you, and you'll find amazing new resources of information. Go check it out at addictomatic.com. This week, a Windows friend of mine asked me for a free tool for Windows that would help him pull audio from a commercial DVD. I know this is a gray or even possibly a dark gray area, but I still wanted to find out what was out there to help him. Remember, I said he was on Windows. Of course, I turned to the best technical resource I know, Twitter. Unfortunately, based on the research they did for me, there aren't any great options like Audio Hijack Pro on the Mac from RogueAmoeba.com. My favorite example of how Audio Hijack Pro helped us was when Steve drove to a real brick-and-mortar store, took out his credit card, bought a physical CD. On the package, it said there was a free bonus track available as a digital download. How exciting! So he brings it home, drops it into the Mac, and guess what? The track is only available if you're using Windows. He was so mad. We dodged around their idiocy, though. All I did was launch Parallels on my Mac and Windows on top of that. I downloaded the file on the Windows side, then I launched Audio Hijack Pro on the Mac side. I told Audio Hijack Pro to capture everything coming out of the sound card, and then I told Windows to play the song. Voila! I had captured a perfect digital copy of the song onto the Mac side. The song we had already paid for, let's make sure that's perfectly clear. So anyway, The problem we're trying to solve here, though, is free tools on Windows for ripping the audio from a DVD. Adrian Bacon came up with a workable but painful method. He said, I use DVD Ripper, then AZID, to convert the DVD stream to a WAV file. Then I can do what I want with it. Involved, but perfect quality. Well, the real downside to ripping the DVD is it takes a long time. I mean, it can take hours. And, you know, the length of the song, you're talking maybe a three-minute song or something at most. I did a search for AZID, and their website is, quote-unquote, down for a while, which made me nervous, but I found it on a legitimate site over at Softpedia. So it's probably not dodgy software. I trust Softpedia. Well, the real fun began when my buddy Andy McCaskey from Slashdotreview.com sent a link to MaximumPC.com, MaximumPC.com, where they've compiled a list of 32 totally essential and free applications for every new PC. This list is fantastic. There's a lot of the usual suspects, you know, like VLC for video playback, Thunderbird for email, PuTTY for logging into servers, but there's also a lot of apps I'd never even heard of in here. For example, a product called RipBot 264 is an alternative to Handbrake that's supposed to allow you to rip high-def DVDs. Or how about a file recovery program called Recuva? Hadn't heard of that. They say it holds your hand and tells you everything's going to be okay. What goes and finds the photos of your daughter's birth that you accidentally deleted and your wife is going to kill you if you don't recover. Well, check out this great list. I put the link in the show notes. It's really long, but it's over at MaximumPC.com. And make sure you make it to the last page where they describe some software called InstallPad, which allows you to have an easy way to install all these applications, including the 31 here and others that they recommend, with one application. Thanks, Andy. That was really cool. Well, about 2 years ago, I promised to do an Audacity tutorial showing you how to record and create podcasts with it. I did a bunch of work by hand, taking screen captures and writing up text to go with it, and just dreading wrapping all that together. Then I procrastinated. About a year ago, I got screen steps for the first time, and the first thing I did was start working on that Audacity tutorial again. I stopped for some reason, I think because I got myself tangled up in describing every single little feature in the tool instead of focusing on the bigger picture, which was how do you create a podcast with it. Finally, some people I work with begged for the instructions on how to make a podcast for free, so my hand was forced. I started over completely, and that finally did the trick. I've posted the tutorial in the right-hand sidebar over at podfeet.com under Tutorials. I know, pretty tricky place to put it, don't you think? Anyway, in this version of the Audacity tutorial, I explain where to get it, which version to choose from. Hint, use the beta. It's really good. And then I walk through some real basic steps to record. I explain how to set your audio to receive your microphone and recommended settings for the quality. You can use Audacity to create MP3 files, but it's sort of a weird boogery process to get it to work. You have to download the lame encoders, and it's kind of weird. And I figure since you've got a perfectly good MP3 encoder right there inside of iTunes, and since I recommend using iTunes to add all the metadata anyway, you know, like author, genre, and all that, why not just use iTunes? Let me know what you guys think, and let me know where you think I should elaborate, because I can expand it. I can expand it like crazy, because I use screen steps, because it was so easy. Well, should I go into more detail on how to actually edit the recordings in Audacity, or can you figure that out? I mean, it's pretty easy. You, like, grab a section, hit cut, it cuts, and it pulls the pieces together, you know. There's all kinds of filters. There's a lot I could talk about, but I don't know how to use everything in there. Anyway, tell me, what do you wish you knew more about getting along with Audacity? So do you guys remember when I nearly committed Harry Carey after I stuck a magnet to my brand spanking new MacBook Pro? I remember it was Pat Dengler who talked me down off the ceiling and helped me breathe again? Well, she's the same woman who upgraded the drive for me in my old MacBook Pro and seemed to actually enjoy it. I'm telling you, there's nothing like having in-home service of your Mac if you live in the LA area. Hey, wait, that reminds me of someone. Well, anyway, Pat does repair of computers and does all kinds of great Mac stuff. She's a really, really talented. And if you are interested in getting service from her and you live in the area, I've got a link to her in my blog roll on the right-hand sidebar of podfeet.com. But anyway, I told you all that because I wanted to remind you who she was. She just sent in her first audio review. She chose to review the Amazon Kindle 2. I know we've heard a lot of hype about it lately, but this is a real person who will explain exactly what it's like in a real person's hands. Let's have a listen to her review.
Hello, Allison and the NoSillyCast universe. This is Pat Dangler. On a whim, I decided to take a look at and then purchase the Kindle 2 that came out last Monday. So here's a very quick review of the Kindle. It's about the size of a DVD case. It's about a half inch longer and maybe half as thick. Feels really solid, a really nice piece of equipment. It's got 2 gigabytes of storage, of which 1.4 gigs are available for the books that you download, and also any MP3s that you want to add, or any audiobooks that you want to add, or any of your own documents that you want to throw on there. I'll get back to that in a minute. It uses a file type called .azw, which is Amazon's proprietary DRM restricted format, but it will also read the .mobi and .prc format that MobiPocket uses. And Amazon will, as a service, convert your documents, either HTML, JPEGs, docs, GIFs, PNG, BMP. It's 10 cents a shot. You email it to Amazon, and then they will send it down to your Kindle. There's a free alternative. You also send it to Amazon, and then they send it back to you as an email. And when you connect your Kindle to your computer, you just drag and drop the file into the documents folder, and it'll come up so that you can read it on the Kindle as a .azw document. Either using the built-in browser, or when Amazon sends you your books that you've purchased, they use what they call their WhisperNet, which is actually Sprint's 3G and or EVDO networks. When you connect it to your computer, it's connected via USB on the computer end, and then the USB Mini B on the Kindle end. So that's not the most common cord, at least I don't usually carry one of those with me. So if you plan on adding anything to your Kindle while you're out and about, you're going to have to carry that with you. It also doubles as your charger cable. For getting around on the Kindle, it's really nice. The buttons require a very deliberate push, avoiding those accidental page turns. The bottom left-hand corner shows a percentage of your progress in the book that you're reading, for example. There's also something called location, which is a page number of sorts. There are a few handy keyboard shortcuts. For example, if you want to initiate the text-to-speech and also the search function, you just start typing a word and it'll search for that word within the document. While you're reading, you can highlight passages. You can dog-ear the pages. It'll put a little mark on the top right-hand corner of the page. And you can also save page clippings, which you can later export via USB as text files onto your computer. One of the major differences between the Kindle 2 and the Kindle 1 is this text-to-speech feature, which allows you to have a computerized voice read back what it is that you're reading, and I'll play you a little demo of it right here.
Thank you for purchasing Amazon Kindle 2. You are reading the welcome section of the Kindle 2 User's Guide. This section provides an overview of Kindle 2 and highlights a few basic features.
As you heard, it's not going to put any audiobook actors out of business because it's, I think, a practical feature to have, but it's certainly not going to replace actually listening to an audiobook. It's really easy to add content to the Kindle, either through Amazon's website. Whatever you purchase on the website will be sent via the WhisperNet to the Kindle, or you can purchase via the Kindle directly if you're not on a computer, which makes it really nice. On the Kindle, you can shop in a few different categories, books, of which Amazon says they have 240,000 different books that are ready for the Kindle. Newspapers, they have 31 newspapers from 7 different countries, 24 in the U.S., and if Bart's interested, they do have the Irish Times available. Magazines are 24, and blogs, there are over 1,300 listed. None of them are free so far, at least I haven't found any free ones. The blogs are pretty cheap. They're about $1.99 a month. However, if you open up the WhisperNet via the browser, you can actually navigate to those blogs and read them that way for free. Now, I will say this, though. It reminds me of surfing the web on my old Palm Treo. It doesn't compare to surfing the web on the computer or your iPhone even. The book section is nice because they have it divided into a couple different topics: the national bestsellers, Kindle top sellers, new books, and then recommended books based on your Amazon account, which is nice. It uses your Amazon one-click account, but then there is a handy purchase by accident / cancel button in case you change your mind. The consensus among reviewers is that Amazon did a really good job of finding those things that needed some tweaking on the Kindle One, and then they added a couple nice handy little features. The shape of the Kindle and what it's made of feels really nice and solid in the hand, and all in all, I'd definitely recommend this as a purchase. Well done, Amazon.
Well, thanks, Pat. I can't believe that was your first review. It sounded great. So one thing I wanted to point out, a lot of people are concerned that there's no SD card in the Kindle 2 yet, or now. The Kindle 1, I think, had one and only has 1.4 gigabytes of space for the books. But go back and find a folder that you've got that's got a lot of text files in it, and look at how small it is. Text is really, really teeny. I remember one year I had to move, I'd moved the data from my Macs to my Macs to my Macs over the years. I just grabbed the whole data folder and moved it over each year. And then one year I realized I couldn't move the hard drive, and that's the way I'd done it every time. So this time I was going to have to burn it to CDs. And I was like, oh my gosh, how many CDs is this going to be? And it was like 10 years worth of every document I had ever written for work. Okay, this was every Excel file, every Word file, every PowerPoint file I had ever made in like 10 years. It will fit on a 600 meg CD. I mean, text is really, really teeny. We're used to these huge data files now, you know, with audio and video and all that. And text is small. So a book, it's not going to be that big. So don't worry about the size, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Thanks again, Pat. That was really interesting. I'm really thinking I might want one of those. I don't need one, but I'm kind of wanting one. All right. So you've heard me whining frequently about how Time Machine doesn't work for Steve or me, right? Because we create these huge files every week. I create audio, he creates video, and all those copies of the data aren't really solving the problem we had. We just wanted backups. I still tried it a bunch of times for Steve, and I just couldn't seem to get it to work for him. You'll be shocked and surprised at what does work well for him, though. And I wanted to make sure I told you guys about it. We bought a MacStore OneTouch backup drive at Costco for him. I use one of these on my Windows box at work, and it's perfection. For me, I let it run in the background while I'm working, and about three or four times, I've realized that I've borked a file, I threw something away, I installed something, I wrote over something. Every single time, I've been able to just check on the MacStore drive, and it was there. That unattended backup is essential to a good strategy. But here's where the OneTouch comes into full glory. Let's say you've just finished downloading the pictures of your baby's birth. Remember those ones you don't ever want to lose, and you don't want anything to happen to these, or your wife is going to kill you? Remember we talked about that earlier? All you do is you just downloaded those pictures, you reach over to the OneTouch, and you push the OneTouch button, and bam, it runs a backup. Now, I know I'm a big lover of SuperDuper for me, and you can do that kind of thing with SuperDuper, but, you know, you have to launch the program, say backup now, and all those kinds of things. It's just really satisfying to just go, now, I want it now, just pushed it. So at first when I set it up for Steve, we set it up to backup at intervals the way I have it at work. But the problem was it would wake up his machine and fire up a backup in the middle of the night. So that wasn't a really good solution. Now, I think you're supposed to be able to make it not backup, not wake up the machine, but we didn't figure that out. But he decided that it would be easier for him if, like, right when he finishes doing a whole bunch of work on a video, he can just push that handy little button on the front and say, now. He really, really likes it that way. We ended up shutting off the auto backup function completely, and he instantly backs up whenever he thinks of it. I sure hope he does think of it. I think he will, though, because he's been trying so hard to get one of these things going for him. I can tell you that when I sat down to do our taxes on his machine, because it's not a laptop and never wanders from the house, I figure it's a better place to do taxes than my laptop. After I spent about 3 hours working on these taxes, you can be sure I remembered to click that one button on the Mac Store OneTouch. It's not a great deal, you know, most of the time. I don't know. The price isn't that great. 750 gigs at for $120 right now at Amazon. And I think we paid about that, or, you know, possibly it was $110, something like that at Costco. I know you can get drives cheaper, but the key here is this really, really works well. And it works well for him. One more thing. When I first got the drive, my first intention, though, was to scrape off all that silly OneTouch software and install SuperDuper to work with the drive. Turns out they make it kind of hard to get off, and there's a bunch of shenanigans you got to be able to do. I looked online. I found some solutions. Trying to reformat the drive, I actually couldn't get things to work at all. So I forget exactly what went wrong, but I finally gave in and just let OneTouch rule the backups. Now we're really happy. Those of you who like to control things, though, this is not the right drive to buy for you. But for those who just want to say backup now, it's fantastic. This week, I had some more fun with Nightwise. He convinced me that just putting Ubuntu on my OLPC was not enough. Just having Linux wasn't, I mean, heck, that's hardly a challenge. He said I needed to make it into a Linux server now. What the heck? Sounded like fun. The great news is that on his podcast over at nightwise.com, that's K-N-I-G-H-T, by the way, he's done some fabulous video tutorials on how to install a Linux server. It's a great screencast because he shows you every single step of the way, but he also explains why you're doing each step, so it's easier to remember. When I did the original OLPC Ubuntu install, I was just blindly typing in the commands because the instructions didn't give you a bit of information on what you were doing for each step. I did have some trouble. I'm sure it's operator trouble, not Nightwise's video instructions. But I found myself suggesting to him that a great companion to his video would be a Screen Steps tutorial. The video is great for the concepts, but trying to scan with the playhead back to the screen where he opens the interface files to enter the static IP address, it was hard to find the exact right spot as I tried to type it in. Especially getting it to stop on the right spot so I could read it on the big screen, then take off my regular glasses, and then peer an inch away from the teeny tiny little OLPC screen to see if I was typing it right. A Screen Steps tutorial would have allowed me to go back through the steps and read the text much more easily. He could have done screenshots and annotated them so easily with Screen Steps and then put in the bit of text necessary to explain each step. One quick click of the export button, he could have had the instructions right up on his blog for everyone to see them. Hey, Sass, I have an idea. Maybe you should get him a copy of Screen Steps for his birthday. That'd be great for me. It's only $40 for the standard version and $60 for the pro version. And don't forget the 25% off coupon if you enter my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, Nocilla. Head on over to screensteps.com and buy it. So iPhones and iPod Touches are great, right? We love them. The problem with them is that they're too fun. We want to play with them all the time. Let's say you're at a conference, for example. You've got all that Twittering to do. By the time the dinner invite's starting to go out, you're already out of battery power. What do you do? Well, it turns out a whole slew of manufacturers have set their minds to solving this problem for us. The good news is that there are options. The bad news is that you have to choose. The basic idea of these devices is that you charge them up and then attach them in some fashion to your iPhone, and then they transfer their power over to the iPhone or iPod Touch. I've looked at a few of them, and it appears that the big differentiators are how they attach and how many milliamp hours they can deliver. All right, wait a minute. What's a milliamp hour? What's it a measure of anyway? I found this description on stevesforum.com. No relation to my Steve. Voltage and milliamp hours are two different but interrelated things. Voltage is a measure of the electrical power that a battery can deliver, while milliamp hours is a measure of how long the battery will maintain usable voltage at a given output current. A 2500 milliamp battery should provide approximately twice the life of a 1200 milliamp cell in the same application, even though their output voltages are the same. Okay, so what I got out of that is more milliamp hours is better. Twice as many milliamp hours is twice as much charge in time, right? Sounds good. You want a whole lot of them milliamp hours, I'm pretty sure of that. Well, several of my friends, including Victor Cahiao of the Typical Mac User podcast, had the Mophie Juice Pack on their iPhones at Macworld Expo this year. The Mophie Juice Pack is sort of like an iPhone case. You slide the iPhone or iPod Touch into the case with the dock connector, and it starts charging the device. The Mophy runs $100, and it gives you 1,800 milliamp hours. I liked it, and I thought it was pretty cool, and I had some serious gadget envy. It was pretty big, essentially doubling the size of the iPhone, but for doubling the time, you could Twitter on your iPhone iPod Touch all day. It was a great solution. They make the juice pack for both generations of the iPhone iPod Touch, which is also cool. Then this week, my friend Brian showed up at my door Friday and said, "I have the coolest thing since sliced bread." He showed me the Kensington Mini Battery Pack and Charger. This is a whole different device. It's a tiny little device that connects to the end of the iPod Touch, or iPod, or iPhone, on the dock connector, essentially lengthening the device, not thickening it. Does that make sense? The Kensington device is only $50, so the price is right, that's for sure. The Kensington battery pack only has 1,000 milliamp hours, and as we learned in our earlier lesson, that's not nearly as good as 1,800, right? But it is half the price and half the size, maybe even less than half the size. Here's another good point for the Kensington. Since it just plugs into the end with the device, it doesn't just work to work on the iPhone iPod Touch. It also works on Nanos of all generations and iPods of all generations, too. The downside of the Kensington is it feels like you might snap it off if you tried to carry it around and use it while it's attached, because it's sort of like hanging off the end of your device. But again, at half the cost and really small and light to carry around, it only weighs 1.6 ounces. I think it's kind of a very interesting solution. Okay, so you think we have this all wrapped up, right? High capacity, go to Mophy, small and light, go to Kensington. Well, that's way too easy, isn't it? My good buddy David Sparks of I Love a Woman Who Travels with the Internet in Her Purse fame did a great review of the Richard Solo 1800 over on MacSparky.com back in December. There's a little link to it in the show notes, of course. The Richard Solo takes the middle ground. It also attaches to the end of the iPhone iPod Touch, but it's much bigger than the Kensington and delivers the 1,800 milliamp hours of the Mophy. They even priced it halfway between the other two options. It's $70. David loves this unit. Okay, great. Now what do? Well, let's introduce a fourth player in the market. At the end of Macworld Expo, after I swear I'd been to every single booth on that floor in 3 days, my buddy Jonathan Witherspoon says, "Hey, did you go to the FastMac booth? Best in show by far is the IV from FastMac." Oh, great. What could I do but get my hands on the IV and give it for a spin? Here's the specs before we get started. The IV from FastMac does not have 1,000 milliamps. It doesn't have 1,800 like the Richard Solo 1800. It has 3,100 milliamp hours. This bad boy will take a completely dead iPhone and charge it to 100%. Twice. Seriously. You think this one would break the bank because 3,100 milliamp hours, but it's actually $80 for the iPhone first generation, they call it the 2G, and $100 for the 3G iPhone. I was excited that they supported the first gen of the iPhone since that's the one I have. The IV is most comparable to the Mophy 2 because it's more of a case-type charger. While it just about doubles the thickness of the iPhone, it's very usable with the IV hooked onto it. There's no way you'd walk around with a Richard Solo or a Kensington attached to the end of your iPhone because instead of making it thicker, again, it makes it longer, and you'd kind of feel like you're going to break that off, I think. The IV from FastMac has a fantastic feel to it. It has this soft finish that I really like to stroke. I don't get creepy here, but it really, really feels good. It also has a very bright LED light on the camera side, which at first I thought was silly, but they point out that it's pretty handy to use to light things up when you want to take a picture with the incredibly poor camera on the iPhone. Getting some extra light in really makes the camera a lot more useful. Here's another nice touch. I happen to travel with an iPhone and a BlackBerry and, of course, my Cradlepoint. Heck, sometimes I've even got a Garmin GPS unit with me. So, I've got the Cradlepoint so I can carry the internet in my purse. Gotta have all these gadgets. Well, what if one of those devices loses its charge while I'm out and about? No worries, the IV can charge them too. With the flick of a switch, I can turn on power to a built-in USB port on the IV so I can charge any USB device. They've integrated all of these options in a nice, clean way so you don't even notice the ports on the bottom until you go looking for them. In fact, there's even a dock connector on the bottom, too, so you can charge the IV while the iPhone is docked into it, so you're charging the whole string of things. This also means you don't have to carry around a third-party cable like some of the other options. Your standard iPhone iPod connector cable works perfectly. I mentioned that the 3G iPhone version of the IV is $20 more, but without thinking, I handed the IV for the 2G that I have in to my buddy Ron, who plugged in his 3G iPhone. And it plugged in right away and started charging. And it fit just fine. I'll have to ask the folks at FastMac why they have a separate version if this one works. Hope I didn't do any damage to the iPhone. I know it has different charging capacities and needs, so I'm not really sure. They also include two little party favors, is the best way I can think of it, in the box. Not sure why they put them in there, but they're a nice touch. You get a free hard plastic screen protector for the iPhone and a headphone extension cable with a microphone in it. I think the idea is that if you lose your iPhone headphones, you could still use a regular set of headphones, plug them into this, and retain the microphone and clip it to your shirt to keep the mic in the right place. Nice little touch. Michael from FastMac told me that the IV works best if you wait till your iPhone drains to 10 or 20% and then charge it with the IV for 45 minutes. That'll give you a full charge that way, and you can charge more often with the IV. I took his word for this because it was way too much math for me to catch the iPhone drain to a precise number, let my battery drain pretty far down, stuck it in the IV, and check to... It just all sounded too hard. So I just let my battery drain for a couple of days. I stuck it in the IV, and I checked it a while later, and it was charged 100% back up. I can think of so many situations where you could use the IV. I mentioned you're at a conference with all that twittering, but what about normal people going to things like on camping trips or on a boat? Or maybe you're just even away a few days on travel. You could use it as your charging station for all your other devices. I'm very happy with the IV from FastMac, and I would definitely recommend it. Thanks to Jonathan for bugging me to check this out. Check it out yourself at FastMac.com.
Oh no, my Honda broke down. I know just who to call. Let's see, 562-531-2321.
Hello?
Oh, Honda Bob. Thank God. I have a problem with my Honda. I need your help.
Do you live in the L.A. or Orange County area?
I sure do.
I'm on my way.
Oh, Bob, your life's in. Oh, you're here already. I'll just be in here playing on my Macintosh until you're done.
This won't take long at all. All finished.
Thanks a million, Honda Bob.
No problem. And remember, if you ever need my service again, you can email me at hdabob@aol.com. Check out my website at hdabob.com. Or call me at 562-531-2321. And remember, my mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
Well, it's time for a really, really exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. Today, we are live on Ustream. We have figured out how to stream both of our little faces on Ustream.
Yeah, mine's coming across very pixely, and I'm wearing a luminous blue bathrobe because I'm dying of a cold, and I just want to keep my lovely warm bathrobe on. And I look like a chump because I haven't shaved in a week and a half. But other than that, it's a great idea.
Well, now I warned Bart. I said, what you want to do is set the bar really low at the beginning. You don't want to show up in a suit and a tie with your hair combed or anything because then they'll expect it. So I think you have a ways up to go from there, Bart.
Well, the hair is actually brushed. So that's a step. That's one step up. I didn't start at the very bottom.
There you go.
I also remember to wear clothes.
Well, yeah, we got a,
another
yeah,
plus.
A lot of steps going here.
Actually, I forgot. I actually technically forgot to wear some of my clothes to work yesterday. It was most annoying.
I used to have
the only T-shirt I had was
that.
this raggy old black T-shirt. But I said it doesn't matter because I'm going to be wearing a shirt, which I have to remember to take off the clothes horse before I go out the front door. I missed that bit, so I came into work, took off my jacket, and went crud. So I kept the jacket on all day.
Did you ever used to have that nightmare where you'd go to school and realize that you went to school without your clothes on? Yeah, usually pants.
Yeah, I've had that horrible nightmare.
I was at a party once where I met someone who'd never had that dream, and they couldn't believe me that I was, they thought I was the only one, and we did a poll, and every single other person at the party had had that same dream. What I always find interesting is I get it where I'm halfway to school, and I realize I don't have pants on, and I think, oh, God, but it's too far to go back.
Yeah. I haven't had that one. Anyway.
Okay. We were doing a tech show here, I think. But let's see. We actually have a couple of topics here. Before we get into Security Light, you wanted to make a comment. When I was talking to Nightwise last week about his grandmother, his wife's grandmother being on Linux, you said you have a great grandparent on Linux as well.
Yeah, I was. I mean, you know, it was a great show last week. I really enjoyed listening to you guys chat away. Three people on Chit Chat Across the Pond was an interesting change. But no, it was a really good show, and I really enjoyed it. So, you know, it takes a Belgian to fill a Belgian's shoes, as they say.
I felt like I was cheating on you, though.
No, it's fine. I've been on other podcasts, too. I've cheated on you loads of times.
Okay.
But I was actually very funny because what I had been thinking to myself while I was away is, oh, I must remember to tell Alison about how well my grandfather's getting on with Ubuntu. And then I turn on the Nozillacast and there's people talking about grandparents with Ubuntu. And I'm going, yeah, that's my good story, just been snaked. But it's it's not quite as impressive, though, because my grandfather's only been using it for a couple of months. Hmm. I set him up with it. He got very badly virused a while ago on his Windows machine. And I was like, okay, so what do you use this machine for? And he went, well, email, internet, and Skype. I was like, okay, so why are you using Windows? I was like, well, because that's what's on my computer. I was like, okay, we can change that, and we'll fix that problem then. So he now has a dual boot machine with Windows XP for his few games he plays occasionally, but mainly he just played Solitaire, and we have Solitaire on Linux, so that was all good. So he's been using it for a couple of months now, and I said, you know, so how are you finding it? And he said, well, it's fine. I don't remember the last time I used Windows.
Wow.
Said, good. Mission accomplished.
It almost seems, you know, part of the discussion was about how mainstream is, could Linux be today? And I think in a way, if you're a really, really simple user, maybe it's an ideal operating system. If you're, you know,
it's
you don't
perfect
do hardly
netbook
anything.
Operating system.
Right, right. That's
yeah, especially with all, you know, they don't have much grunt.
They don't have much what?
Grunt power.
Oomph. But I mean, yeah. You know, for sophisticated users, it works. For the mid-range people like me, where I'm pretty sophisticated, but I don't know Linux very well, it's frustrating because I'm always trying to load new applications and I don't really know how to do it very well. Nightwise gave me some tips on how to do it now in Ubuntu and maybe it'll be easier for me. But so the mid-range people maybe would have more difficulty with it, but then the lowest end users, they might be perfect again.
Well, I think, yeah, because at the end of the day, when my grandfather was using Windows, I installed everything for him. Mm-hmm. So now that he's using Linux, I install everything for him.
Right.
So what's changing his end?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, we actually do have a Security Light, which I was supposed to do last week in your absence, and I totally forgot until I was about 90% of the way through the show. So why don't you fill us in on...
yeah, and then it multiplied.
Oh, great.
It's now become three. It was just the one. The first one is a real Security Light because it properly fits the definition. The other two are a little more dodgy, but I think they're important, so I put them in.
Okay.
Adobe have released an update to Flash, which addresses security vulnerabilities. Considering Flash is web-based, and therefore if you stroll onto the wrong web page, you can be walloped by these things, it's a really, really, really important one to update, probably about as important as it gets. Hmm. This is cross-platform, so it's for everyone, Windows, Linux, Mac. And my Flash did not automatically update on OS X. I don't know why or how that's supposed to happen, but nothing happened. So
really
I went and manually
updated. Because you don't really launch Flash for it to get a trigger to do that, right? You just sort of start using it on a site, maybe?
Yeah, but that's launching it, surely. But I don't know. No updates came. So I went, okay, I'm going to force this Flash's hand. So I went to the Adobe site, downloaded its version, and installed it. Painless install. But there's also an important link in the show notes, which is to the Flash About page on Adobe site, and that lists the latest version of Flash for every operating system, and there's a little sort of tiny little Flash thing in the page that shows you what version of Flash you're running. So you just need to go in there and compare and make sure that you're correct. And you need to do that for every browser you use. Now, in theory, the Flash updater should update them all, but it may not. So just check them all. Okay. What I can tell you is that the updater updated my Safari, it updated my Firefox, it updated my Camino, and it updated my NetNewsWire.
Oh, so, wait. Your blog readers or your RSS readers have to do it too?
Well, NetNewsWire is a web browser.
Yeah, I guess so. It's got an embedded web browser thing, right?
I'm pretty sure it's embedded Safari, so it doesn't entirely surprise me that it picked up on the Safari one.
Oh, okay. All right, well, so what's
the next? A lot of things are web. Okay, so next is Adobe again, and this is the one you were supposed to do last week.
Okay.
I think. Was that the Flash one? Anyway, there's a major problem discovered in Acrobat and Adobe Reader. Cross-platform again, so everyone gets to play again. And remote code execution again, and PDFs are all over the net again. So this is up there on the list of bad things. This really affects Windows users more than anyone else, because on Windows, everyone pretty much runs Adobe's Reader at least, if not their Acrobat as well, because Windows doesn't do PDF on its own. Linux users will get KPDF or something with the operating system, and Mac users have Preview, so much less of us bother installing Adobe's tools.
Right. I checked, and I don't have Adobe Acrobat Reader on my Mac.
Yeah, I don't either. I hate those programs. They're bloatware and rubbish because they're from Adobe. I don't like Adobe. But if you do have them, you need to be careful on this. This is a problem. Now, whichever genius thought it was a good idea to embed a JavaScript inside PDF files should probably be taken out and shot. But the problem here is with JavaScript inside PDF files. So you need to go into Adobe Acrobat and or Reader and go into their settings and disable JavaScript. Now, I can't actually show you screenshots because I don't have any of these programs installed. And I wouldn't, even if you paid me. But that's the instructions, is to disable JavaScript within these programs. Something else you might want to do is install the RC Default app, which we've talked about many times, and make sure that your default PDF reader is not one of these Adobe products, because otherwise you surf to a random web page, click on a PDF, and boom, you know, not good.
Yikes. Huh, so finally, there is no
Oh, wait,
fix,
there's
though,
one bit
right?
of good news. There is no fix, but there is a date. So Adobe have promised a fix on March 11th.
Okay.
So until then, be careful.
Alrighty.
The next one, this is the worst piece of news, from our good friends in Redmond, Microsoft. In your favorite Microsoft program, Excel.
Oh, not Excel. Nothing's wrong with Excel.
Unfortunately, there is. Remote code execution, the usual carry-on. Sorry. So there is no fix. There is no scheduled date for a fix. The only real workaround is not to open Excel files from untrusted sources.
So it's only on Windows, though?
No, Mac as well. Yeah, I know. I didn't think you'd like that, but there you go.
Are you sure it wasn't PowerPoint?
No, I'm very sure it was Excel. I'm very sorry.
Well, I suppose it's not too common that bad guys, send you Excel files, though, or that you would be expecting an Excel file from an unknown source.
Yeah, so don't open Excel files you weren't expecting. If someone rings you up and says, I'm about to send an Excel file, and there's someone you know and trust, yeah, whatever, go for it. Email around Excel files didn't work all the time, because you kind of have to.
Right.
But if you get in a random Excel file you weren't expecting, or if you get an Excel file from someone you weren't expecting one from or don't know, don't open it. Just asking for trouble.
Okie dokie. Well, that sounds like a lot of security fun this week. Well, let's see.
Yeah, it's security quite heavy, really.
Yeah, really. Well, let's get into something fun. I wanted to ask you, and you were shocked that we were going to talk about something about cameras that you didn't beg for the question to get to talk about it. So I've been hearing a lot about RAW versus JPEG, and I have a vague idea of what RAW is, but I don't completely understand it. I have the Nikon D40, and it does shoot RAW, and I think a lot more cameras are coming with RAW these days, and I believe iPhoto can handle RAW now, right?
Yeah, it doesn't do very much with it, but it can handle it.
Okay, and Aperture has a lot of RAW support, and people are all yapping about RAW this, RAW that. I really debated whether I should make this, okay, RAW is stupid, prove to me I'm wrong, but I decided to go a different route just to shake things up this time. Teach me, why would I care about RAW? Give me examples of photographs I take, what I would do with them, why?
Okay. I've been thinking about this, and I think the best way to go is to explain, without going into horrible detail, exactly what is going on in your camera when you take a picture. Because as soon as you understand what's going on, you suddenly realize what is happening when you save JPEG instead of RAW, and why you might not want that to be done by the camera. Basically, your camera's a little computer, and when you save it in JPEG, that camera is making assumptions on your behalf. And you may not be happy with those assumptions. And once it's become a JPEG, you can't change those assumptions. Whereas if you keep it as a RAW, you can. And, you know, I've always said computers are stupid, and small computers inside cameras are even stupider.
Okay. What kind of assumptions is it making for me? I thought it was just compressing the file.
No, it's not. It's doing a lot more. So let's start with how what is going on with your camera. So the little shutter flips up, light comes through the lens and goes into your sensor. What's going on there? So really what's happening is that your sensor is a collection of buckets. That's actually their technical term, little buckets. And those buckets count how much light hits them over the time that the light is allowed to hit them. So one photon becomes one electron, basically. And at the end of the day, you just count the number of electrons.
Okay.
That would, of course, give you a black and white image, because that only knows how much light is coming in. So there's actually one third of the buckets have a red filter in front of them, so only red light comes into those buckets. Oh. One third have a blue filter, and one third have a green filter. So you count how much red photons, how much green photons, and how much blue photons. And that's enough to give you colour back. RGB, same as your television, only instead of spitting it out, you take it in.
Okay.
So it's an inverse television.
That's interesting. Okay. I'm with you so far. You haven't lost me.
Okay. Now, you've probably noticed that there's nothing that's really white in this world. Our eyes are very smart, and our brains are very smart. So I can take a piece of paper, and I can look at it inside under incandescent lights, and I will see it as white. I can take that same piece of paper and walk out into a beautiful sunset, and I will still see it as white. I can walk into another room with a fluorescent light, and I will still see it as white. If you actually were to measure the light, it's never white, because white light is equal amounts of everything. If you walk out in the middle of the day, sunlight is yellow. So it's not equal amounts of everything, there's more yellow. If you walk into fluorescent light, there's loads and loads of yellow there. So it's even more yellow. Fluorescent lights are blue, incandescents are yellow, sunset is deeply orange. So at no point it is actually really white light if you were to physically measure it. And of course, cameras physically measure. So if you were to just take the raw information out of the camera and turn it into a photograph, white would never look white, ever. Because we just don't have white light sources.
Okay.
So, you know, you would, every time you took a photograph of someone indoors in incandescent light, they would turn into Oompa Loompas. They would have a horrible orange color. We quite clearly do not want this. So what actually happens is that there's a little bit of maths gets done between the raw RGB values and what actually goes into the picture. Now, if you want to go into the horrible, nasty details, it's something called a black body curve. But I don't think we want to do that.
Probably not. Can I ask a little question in here? Would this be where a lot of cameras have a dial or settings where you can say, okay, I'm in incandescent light now? Is that giving it a little bit of information on how to interpret white?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. So all light sources, regardless of what color they are, follow the same shape. It's called a black body curve. And the only thing that actually changes is where the high point is. So if you're outside on a sunny day, the high point is at about 5,000 degrees Kelvin. For some reason, we measure it in degrees Kelvin. I'm not going to go into why, because this is not a physics podcast. I could. I studied all this stuff in quantum physics. If I were to walk then indoors and go into a fluorescent light, it would go right down to the blue end of things, and the high point of the curve would be at about 1,000 or 2,000.
Okay.
But what matters is it's always the same shape. It just shifts over and back. So what we really need to define to nail it down is one number, which is where the high point is. And that's called the white balance. And we measure that in degrees Kelvin.
Okay.
So if you, in aperture, see the white balance slider, it will go from blue to red. And as you slide it over, the numbers will change from about 1,000 to about 7,000 or 8,000. That's degrees Kelvin. And if you want a picture to look right, the temperature you set in on the white balance has to match the light source that you use to take the photograph in. So if you're outside, the white balance has to be set to about 5,000. If you're indoors, it has to be set to a different value. If you're in a fluorescent light, a different value. And if that's wrong, everything just looks wrong. You get Oompa Loompas or luminous blue people or all that kind of silly business.
Okay.
And so a raw file contains literally all of the information, every RGB value for every pixel in the image. It's all there. None of it has gotten rid of. When you make a JPEG, what you actually do is you apply the maths and you only save the answer to the maths into the JPEG. So that means your camera has to make the assumption as to what the value is for the white balance. You can either tell it with the dial, which gives you very rough control because it only gives about 5 or 6 points on a massive scale from 1,000 to 8,000. That's not a lot of control points. Or you can let the camera guess. But cameras are computers, and computers are stupid.
And small computers and cameras are even stupider.
Exactly. So what happens when you shoot JPEG is that the camera makes a guess, does the maths, saves the answer, and throws all the other information in the bin. It's gone forever.
Okay.
So if the guess was wrong, you can't correct it anymore.
Just to bring this to a practical point for a second, a good example would be if you take a picture in snow, and the snow always ends up blue. that pretty much almost
snow,
any dial setting you pick, you're going to get blue snow. So you've lost some of the other colors that are actually in that color of snow, right? And those would have been thrown
away. If you shoot JPEG.
Right.
If you shoot JPEG, they get thrown in the bin. Now, you can tweak it a bit with that slider, but you soon start to end up with unnatural-looking images. There's almost no data for aperture to work with, so it's starting to extrapolate. And when computers extrapolate, they really make a mess of things. So you can move the slider a bit, and it'll be able to correct a little bit, but not a lot. Whereas if you have a RAW file, everything is there. So you can move that slider all the way from 1,000 all the way up to 8,000, and at no point have you lost any information. So at no point is aperture guessing.
Okay, so let's get practical now. So I've got a picture of a snowball fight outside, and I've got green trees, and I've got blue snow because it's JPEG. But I'm going to now take that same photograph, and I get it in RAW. What color is the snow when I look at it in RAW?
It'll be whatever the camera guessed. So it will still show you the guess.
Okay.
But you can adjust that guess without it having to make up information, because all the information is there. So you simply take the little eyedropper, drop it on the snow, and it will not be taking a guess. It will now be taking an exact measure, and it will display the image with the correct white balance.
So as a human interface, what I'm going to see differently in Aperture or in Photoshop Elements, or does Photoshop Elements do RAW?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't have Elements.
Let's assume it does. Well, whatever, your photo editing application.
It's very likely to.
As a human, what I'm going to see, I'm not going to see anything different on the RGB color curve. It's going to look exactly like it always does, but I'll just be able to, I'll see more logical ability to change it to the right thing.
If you adjust it, your image won't go all hinky. As you adjust, you're not going to lose image quality. Because if you adjust the JPEG, you can't push the sliders very far or things start to go horrible.
Right.
With the RAW, you can push the sliders all the way. And it has all the data there it needs to keep generating that image clean, proper. No messing, no noise, no carry-on.
Would it help you not blow out the highlights?
That's the second point. Okay, so that's one of the things that RAW does. That's one of the advantages, is that your color, all the color information is preserved, none of it is thrown away. So you have infinite correction to your white balance. Now, in the real world, right, I have tried when shooting JPEG to get my white balance right out in the field by manually setting it. And you're looking at a teeny tiny little LED display, and you're in the same color of light that you're trying to compensate for. And it will look just fine on the little LED, and then you bring it home and you put it into your machine, and it's still horrible. It's like, oh my God, everyone's blue. But they look just fine on the display. So it's really impractical, which is why I really want that control, because I always get it wrong. And I don't think it's just that I'm silly. I think it's just really hard to do. So you're much better off doing it in post.
Okay.
So that's one thing. The other thing is that a JPEG is a fairly limited file format, and it only has 8 bits of color, of basically exposure depth. It's the difference between the brightest and the darkest thing you can represent in a JPEG is 8 bits wide. It's quite narrow. So what that means is that your camera is actually taking more information, and then when you make it a JPEG, it takes everything off the top and throws it in the bin, and everything off the bottom and throws it in the bin, and then gives you a JPEG. Which means that your highlights are lost and your shadows are lost. On the RAW file, the information is still there. So when you slide those little adjustment sliders, it can pull that information up into the image.
Ah.
Which it can't do with a JPEG. When you do that with a JPEG, it's guessing, it's extrapolating.
Right, right.
Whereas when you do it with a RAW, the real data is down there. And it's just getting at that real data and presenting it to you.
Would it even be a more clear thing to say is that it's actually interpolating? That it's only got those 8 points, so it's got to interpolate between them?
Exactly. Yeah, with the JPEG, those 8 bits, which is not 8 points, it's 8 bits. It's a little better than that.
Okay.
I think that 8 bits is 2 to the power of 8 points. Anyway, let's not go into the maths. It has a certain range of values it can go, and if you try to stretch or shrink those to get more into your highlights or more into your other, it's interpolating between those and trying to imagine where the color should be. Sorry, where the values of brightness should be. Whereas with the RAW file, it actually has more information above and below. So when you try to say, okay, I need to pull down the exposure a bit, it's not guessing what will be down there. It actually has it. It's there, and it just slides it into view.
Okay.
Because you still only see the 8 bits of data when you're finished processing your RAW, but you can sort of reach up and grab some information and pull it into view.
Interesting.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because you've always got that same window.
Right.
But the window is set in stone in a JPEG. Whereas it's not set in stone in a RAW, you can reach up and grab and pull stuff in. So that means that you know, if you want to have the effect, what effect does it have on me when I'm sitting in front of Aperture or iPhoto? It means that the exposure slider can do much more before your image goes all horrible. It means the recovery slider can do much more. It means the highlight slider can do much more. It means the shadow slider can do much more. And it means that the levels adjustment can do much more.
Hmm. Interesting.
That's
okay.
A lot.
So you don't see it
so
on
so far we have all of those adjustments. Yeah, exactly. Once you try to properly process the image, you have way more at your disposal, so you can do much better adjustments.
So how? What photos would you choose to do raw on? I mean, if you're taking snapshots at a company picnic, or if you're shooting the flowers that you do, what would you do it on all of them?
I shoot everything raw.
Really?
The white balance is just the big thing. I could never go back to having to care about white balance. If you know, imagine some company event. You're probably indoors. Immediately, you're into either mixed light, which is a real nightmare, or you're into trying to figure out is this incandescent +1, +2, +3, or -1, -2, -3 on my Nikon settings. And you can't really judge until you get to your laptop, but you're at the party. So if you're shooting JPEG, you just got to kind of hope. Now, I happen to know that in my house, it's incandescent -3 that works best with my particular brand of light bulb. But if I'm in a room I haven't been in before, I'm not going to know that. So if I'm shooting raw, I don't care.
See, I wonder if
I have infinite control when I get home.
I wonder if this is going to be, I mean, maybe an earlier step I ought to do is actually compensating for white balance, because I don't even do that. I've got the camera with that little dial there. It says, little settings I can change.
It says auto.
It's incandescent. Yeah, I'm pretty much on the P most of the time.
Okay, but yeah, even if you're on the P, you can set your white balance separately in the menus and the Nikons. You have a D40 as well.
Right.
And so you can set it to auto, or you can list off the different types.
It only occurred to me to do that the other day. I was I was at the ACADEC ceremony, and I was fooling around, and I was bored, so I kept changing settings on the camera, and I went into one of the manual modes, and everything I took was blue, and I was like, what the heck is going on here? But it turned out, actually, I think you can't in program mode, because the reason it was all blue was because I had set it for incandescent, or I had set it off of the auto function, but just for the manual mode, not for, and it didn't affect the program mode.
Oh, okay. It depends on what level of automatic your camera's on. If you slide that D40 to complete auto, it doesn't matter what you set the white balance to. It's going to go, you want me in auto? I'm doing full auto.
Yeah. I think the A is where you can change things, but the P, it's just, I'm in charge. Shut up. Take the picture. Join the party.
Yeah, my camera's never in that mode. I don't like, as I say, computers are silly. Little computers and cameras are really silly. So I like to take control. I don't like to leave it to the camera.
So, but if I do set it for RAW
anyway,
and then I set it on P, it would still do RAW.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that means that all that you're really getting is the preview. So the first time you see the RAW, it'll be whatever the camera set, but all the information is there to adjust it.
Now, you don't think that RAW was invented by the hard disk manufacturers to make me buy more of them?
No, no. RAW is a direct result of the fact that JPEG is crappy. So the cameras are recording all this great information and then being forced to throw half of it in the bin. So someone said, why don't we not throw it in the bin? And that's where RAW came from.
Okay. Well, let's talk about exactly how much disk space am I going to lose if I start using RAW?
Okay, I only know with my camera, which is a D40 like you, which is 6 megapixels. Mm-hmm. So on a 6 megapixel camera, I have 4 to 5 megs per RAW file.
So that's only 2.5 times. Most of my photos are around 2 megabytes, I think.
Around 2 megs, so it's around 2.5 times as much.
Okay, that's not too bad.
Yeah, so I still get hundreds of pictures on my 2 gig card.
Yeah, the cards are so cheap and so big now. The 4 gigabyte cards are now $15 at the SanDisk card. So, buy a handful and throw them in the camera bag, and they take up a quarter of an inch. You know.
Yeah, I think actually it's about 265 I get on a 2 gig card.
Okay.
So that's pretty decent.
Yeah. So I mean, that'd do a whole track meet on a 4 gig card then.
Yeah, and then I come in and I edit my picture, so when I'm actually left over afterwards, I have very few left.
Now, do you ever, after you're done working on a photo, do you export it as a JPEG, or do you do next?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to share the image with anyone, it has to come back out as a JPEG. Okay. But you control how that JPEG is rendered, not the silly computer in your camera.
But you only save for yourself the raw image? You don't also save a JPEG in Aperture or anything like that?
No, there's no point in saving a JPEG.
Because you can make another one?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, while it's an Aperture, it's as a RAW file, which for... Okay, RAW, there's no, RAW file is not one standard, by the way. Every camera has its own RAW format. So Nikon's, it's something called a NEF file, .NEF. Canon is something else, and every other make is something else. So I just put the NEF files into Aperture, and really, what actual file is under Aperture, you don't really care about. It just shows up as a little thumbnail, and you can make as many versions out of it as you want.
Right.
And then when you want to share that version, you go File, Export Version, and you say, I'd like it at 800 pixels across, or whatever size you'd like, and boom, out it comes.
I love that. And those eight different versions of the same file are not 8 times 5 megabytes. There's only one 5 megabyte file or 4 to 5 megabyte file with some metadata on top saying, okay, this one has the balance set like this and it's cropped like this. So I love that.
So it doesn't actually change your workflow within Aperture. You know, you don't, you know, as far as you're concerned, you plug in the camera, the little thumbnails pop up, you choose the ones you want, you suck them in. You process them, except all your sliders are just doing more. And then when you're done, you export them out of Aperture like you always would. So it doesn't really change your workflow.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think I'm encouraged to try. I think it's time that I on my to-do list this weekend was taxes, which I did. The next thing I have to do is buy some trip insurance. I got to do that this weekend. My next most annoying task, and I'm doing them in the order of most annoying to least annoying. I've got the fun stuff for the end. But I think I have 2 copies of every photo that I imported into Aperture in the first place, and in some cases 3 copies, because I also pulled in my iPhoto library, which has maybe 20% of what was in my regular library. So I think I've got it, you know, a full set of everything on the outside, and then a 20% set in iPhoto, and then that same 20% sitting inside Aperture, which would be twice because the original stuff's there too. So my third most annoying task to do this weekend was to clean that up. And that'll get me about 40 gig back. So I bought some new enclosures to stick some old drives in so I can stuff that stuff in. Also on my to-do list, by the way, is to make disk-based offsite backups of my home movies. Because you just,
yay!
I know, you're nagging away. I kept going, oh, I've got backups. I've got the DVD. Shut up, Bart. But that's been bothering me. But I'm still running into
trouble. You don't want to lose your memories.
No. Well, I thought we were doing pretty good. I mean, we make a copy for ourselves. We put a pretty sticker on it, which we know degrades the DVD itself. So we made copies that don't have a sticker on them, and those are all sitting in a safe deposit box. And we have all of the original tapes. So, you know, I thought, okay, we're pretty good. And then you're telling me the DVDs are dying on me, so...
Well, I'm just saying that I have had DVDs die on me recently.
Yeah.
Now, I happen to be a cheap student who bought cheap DVDs rather than archive quality, but I'm not sure everyone has those sort of gold-colored, high-quality archive DVDs.
No, ours were all bought on the, hey, look what's on sale this weekend at Office Depot.
Yeah, that's how mine were bought, too.
Right. Actually, and then narrowed down to the ones that never fail, because there were certain brands that pretty much always failed, so... It is depressing.
Poster makers.
Yeah. But I have to still work with you to try to figure out how I'm going to do that, because like I told you, the disk image copy is just simply not working. I keep getting this
we'll figure something out.
Yeah.
We'll figure something.
But that's
anyway, just to wrap up, I just want to say one more thing on the RAW thing.
Okay.
Don't be the only thing you're actually giving up is a little bit of disk space. Because when you suck the photograph in, you don't notice that it's a RAW.
Hmm.
You know,
if you were to just,
it's you're not going to notice that it's RAW because you don't have to do any extra work, right? Your camera has still made its best guess just like it would with JPEG, so that best guess is going to show up on your screen just like it would with JPEG, and you're not going to see a difference until the moment you pick up a slider and move it, and then you have all the extra power. So you don't have to do any more work, but the moment you want to, you can.
So I'm kind of tempted to take 2 of several photos. You know, go around the house and take an inside and outside and take two pictures, one in JPEG and one in RAW, and then look at what I can do with them. I'm kind of tempted to do that.
If you really want to see the power, purposely set the white balance wrong. Because you're going to accidentally do that on something important.
Right. That's true. I know how to make blue ones.
Yeah, so set them to, blue is from sending them to fluorescent. So set them to fluorescent +3. And you should get blue as bejeebus.
And then the 2 photos would come in blue, but I'd be able to fix one of them.
you'll be able to make some changes to both, but the JPEG one, the more you try to fix it, the lower the quality of the image is going to get. The image is going to degrade quite quickly. Stuff is going to start going to black, because you probably have greens or something that should be getting more green put back into them, but there's no more green to put in, so they just go blacker and blacker. Whereas on the raw one, the green is there to inject back in, so the green becomes nice and natural again.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think I could have used this on our the pictures I took for our Christmas picture. We had a lot of red.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. Yeah. Those Christmas tree ones, when you adjusted those, they didn't go back to proper green. The greens went all black because the green was just gone. It wasn't there to put back in.
Right. Actually, I was thinking of the Christmas portraits, the one of our Christmas picture that had the four of us sitting on the couch, and we're all dressed in red, and I didn't use the flash on the camera, and it came out way too red, but it was flatline red. I mean, I couldn't do, there wasn't enough depth to it to be able to adjust it out.
Yeah.
I could make it brown, but I couldn't make it like less red.
Yeah, that's not good. What you're probably having there as well is that you blew the red highlights. This is something that the Nikon cameras will flash when you blow highlights, but that's when you totally blow the highlights. You can blow a third of the highlights. If your green bin was too full, but your blue and your red bins were fine, the Nikon won't flash. But the luminous red jumpers could have all been blown out.
Now, would RAW have saved me on that?
It would have saved you by 1.5 stops up or down.
Okay. Well, that's better than what I had.
And that's quite a bit.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, this has been pretty good. I know I prefer being ornery and arguing with you, but it was a little more important to try to actually learn first, and then I'll come back later and tell you why you're stupid or something, you know?
Well, no, once you've tried it, then we can have an argument.
Right. At this point, I'm not educated enough. So I think I will change the setting. Actually, no. First, I have to do my insurance. Then I got to throw away photos. Then I'm allowed to play with the camera.
Yes, I have to do accounts as well this weekend. Actually, I might be reviewing Cha-Ching next week because I'm starting to get organized and stick all my accounts into Cha-Ching and stuff.
Oh, cool.
So I've paid money so that I have to do more work. Genius.
A lot of people are interested in those money management programs. I know my friends Dean and Suzanne were looking for one, so they'll be interested in hearing what you have to say.
Yeah, it's the, you know, there's an ill wind that blows, what's the phrase? It's an ill wind that blows no one no good or something like that. You know, this recession is terrible for everyone except for the people who sell home finance software.
That's the business to be in, right? What is it they say?
There's always one.
From the gold rush, the people who always made money, the ones that sold the picks and the shovels.
Perfect.
They all
the people who sell coffins, they always make money.
That's terrible. All right, on that lovely note, actually, I should give a shout out to the what was the name of that site I was just telling you about? The Dead People Server. I got to find the exact
output. Yeah,
the link in the show notes, but it's a server. It's a service where you can go find out who's dead. So if you're in an argument, who are you just arguing about?
There was someone trying to tell me that Mr. Higgs of Higgs boson fame had popped his clogs, as the Irish phrase goes, i.e. died, or kicked the bucket, as we like to say. But I was pretty sure he hadn't. Yeah, popped his clogs. Kicked the bucket.
Nice.
Shuffled off this mortal coil. I could keep going.
All we have is kicked the bucket or dead, I think. Well, anyway, I had a lot of fun looking at it last night. I was looking up a couple of people. I kind of stumbled across it because I was trying to figure out, I forget what I was even looking up, and found it. But they have a great program here where if you make a donation to a charity, you can become an officer in their Facebook group for Dead People Server. So I am now Professor Podcaster in the Facebook group. So go on over there and join Laurie Mann's little fun silliness out there and have a good time. I just found the link. It's dpsinfo.com. And then if you click on the right side, you get to Dead People Server. It's good stuff.
Excellent. Definitely going to remember that for arguments.
There we go. On that morbid note, I think we're going to wind it up today, Bart.
Okie dokie. Until next time, happy computing.
Well, looks like that's going to wind up another long show. I want to thank everybody who was in the chat room tonight at Ustream.tv. That was a lot of fun. We had a good time, had some newcomers and some oldcomers. I don't know, is it bad to call people oldcomers? We even had Evan in the chat room who made that fantastic Honda Bob ad. If you want to make a Honda Bob ad too, you can look in the right-hand sidebar at podfeet.com, and it says make your own How to Bob ad. I think that's what it's called over there. And I give you all the instructions, the important salient information you need to get in there. I just love how creative people have been. I've got two or three of them stacked up already in the wings waiting to be played. So we're having a lot of fun with that. So go check that out. And thanks again, Evan. Anyway, if you want to check out the show, it is again at GMT minus 8. It's 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sunday nights. And I really hope you guys can come by sometime. If you can't, be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And of course, keep up your emails, especially those dumb questions, those questions you think nobody else has. It's only you who can't figure this thing out. And send those in, and I'll try to get them answered on the show. Not the hard questions. I mean the dumb questions. Send those in to me at allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed. Thank you.